When I got the first script and I saw this thing that said H-H-H-H and Cox Half Hour, and I thought, well, that's not funny for a start. What does that mean?
We present Tony Hancock, Bill Kerr, Sidney James, Andre Melly, and Kenneth Williams in
Hancock's Half Hour.
And then, of course, when he did it, that one line, his timing on it, and the whole character, the whole comic persona was in that one line. The whole thing of his delusions of grandeur and him sort of falling back into the railway cuttings, the whole thing.
Did you ever get any trouble from the real residents of Cheam about your living there?
No, no, they seem to be quite pleased about it, I think. There was one man called Hancock who lived there who had a bit of a bad time, and he has my deepest sympathy. It must have been murder for him. But no, in general, I think they rather liked it.
Are you going to be sorry to leave the place?
Yes, of course.
Why are you leaving?
It was so comfortable. I'm sorry, but why am I sorry? Well, because it's time we changed and got away from that surrounding, because it means that 7 years on radio and 5 years on television, it begins to limit itself.
How do you feel about this business of playing an artist? You know, frequently on radio and television and now in films, you play artists and intellectuals.
Yes.
Does this mean you'd like to be one?
Well, actually, I think I am deep down, you know. It's never been appreciated entirely, but I think it's there. I think I can safely say that. It's only a question of time.
Before what?
Because it's recognised.
What are you going to do when it's recognised?
I shall be away, shan't I? I mean, that'll be it, won't it? About time, too.
That peculiar little snatch of interview with Tony Hancock happened in 1961, when he'd left his old shabby fictional digs at 23 Railway Cuttings East Cheam and was, though he didn't know it, about to hit the final peak of his fame as a TV comedy star. Among the episodes of the New Look Hancock programme televised later that year were The Bedsitter, The Bowmans, The Radio Ham, The Lift and The Blood Donor, whole chunks of which to this day can be quoted verbatim by Hancock's first-generation fans. But how much of that intellectual recognition stuff did he mean? He was being very sidelong about it, as if he would like to have believed it himself, as if he saw himself as a man with an intellectual destiny of his own. Fair enough, of course, but it's not quite what we expect from comedians. Sid James was surprised, too.
He'd read Freud, he'd read The Origin of Languages. He'd drag me into Harrods, for instance, and he'd browse around that the intellectual section for hours and hours and hours. And he'd pull down the biggest, thickest books you've ever seen in your life and say, I've got to have that one. That'd be about 24 quid or something. And he'd order that. And then he'd see something on acting written by some Russian name that not even Stanislavski's ever heard of, you know. But he had to read this guy. Then he'd grab a book on makeup, which he never ever used, in any case. Never had a thing on his face, ever, when he thought, trying to improve my mind. Well, it's all very well. I think my mind's improved enough. I'm happy enough with it as it is. And he used to get really mad at me. He used to say, for God's sake, learn a little. And I say, I know enough for what I need, Tony. I'm not going to be a professor. I don't want to. Is this going to improve my performance? He said, it might.
Tony, in his private life, was far more intellectual, shall we say, far more cultivated, far more intelligent than the character that we wrote. Although, at the end, they sounded the same, and there were certain personality traits that were the same. In actual fact, I mean, Tony was far more wise than the character.
Ray Galton and Alan Simpson, his scriptwriters through all the Hancock's half-hour years, in conversation with Philip Glassborough. They knew Hancock better than anyone because the character they created, if not squarely based on the real Tony, at least developed along with him. Of all Hancock's helpers, whose story this is, Galton and Simpson were the most influential and diligent and loyal, though in reflecting Hancock's complexities back to him, they probably magnified them in the process. Once upon a time, after all, this had been a man with no apparent complexes at all. In wartime, from the RAF regiment, he joined Ralph Reeder's touring gang show, where, according to Reeder himself, he was an ideal member of the troop.
In those days, he was a joy to be with, and he was one of the favourites of his unit. He used to take everything in his stride. Rehearsals were a lot of fun to him. Sometimes when we called very early rehearsals, sometimes when we had to work three shows a day and probably travel back 40 miles afterwards in an open lorry. He was one of the gay sparks of the crowd.
For some years after the Second World War, Hancock pursued the difficult trade of stand-up comedian, for which he was never ideally suited. But it's notable that as soon as his radio work involved acted situations shared with others, the Hancock character we later knew began to emerge at once.
Any sign of that lifeboat yet? Poor blighters out of this weather. The waves are like mountains. Had a message from the flagship. 11 new boats in the area. Look, there's one surfacing. By heavens, I don't think he's spotted us. Full steam ahead. Action stations. Starboard your helm. Stand by the depth charges. Stand by the forward guns. Fire!
Tony, how much longer are you going to be in that bath?
Wow. Won't be long, Starkey. Just got to escort the scrubbing brush back to port.
With Graham Stark in a sketch from a BBC Star Bill show, well before the onset of Hancock's half hour, but tellingly a script written by Galton and Simpson, who were already playing on the fantasist in Hancock. The failed but pompous daydreamer of East Cheam could easily have played that war game in the bath. Hancock's half hour, when it did start on radio in 1954, was a situation comedy, but only in the sense that there was a situation for Hancock to be in week by week, along with Sid James, Bill Kerr and others. But as Andre Melle discovered when she was cast as the second of Tony's girlfriends, our hero's actual circumstances never became any better defined as the weeks passed.
Nothing was really explained. I mean, it wasn't explained, as far as I remember, unless it had been done in the first series, as to why Sid and Tony were kind of seemed to be living in that same place, or how they knew all these characters like that Ken Williams played, or quite what Bill Kerr was doing. I mean, I think this came out of the earlier comedy series from Itmar onwards. Nobody really gave explanations, or even down to Morecambe and Wise. I mean, how, you know, what were they doing living together? I mean, you've got all these sort of heterosexual couples, obviously, like Sid and Tony and Morecambe and Wise and things. And, you know, what were they doing? Well, how did they come to be living together? It was never, nothing was ever explained like that. It was just sort of taken for granted.
But according to Warren Mitchell, an observer then, but a cast member in later days, the interplay of personalities happened more or less independently of the plausibility of the storyline.
In any show, when you get the relationships right, if they're people who jar with one another, who gel with one another, it reproduces what we know about in real life. But they came across as near enough to real for people to want to listen to and to care about what happened, but funny in the way that Ray and Alan had picked up the foibles of Hancock and highlighted them, so that it really was very, very funny to watch this vain creature squirming, digging his own grave and burying himself in it.
Here, listen. There's a bloke here who can cure gallstones by just putting his hands on your forehead.
That's a funny place to have gallstones.
No. He's got a box, you see, and he transmits life waves. You see, everybody's got life waves, and it says here the box tunes into your life waves, and the waves travel through his fingertips into your forehead and smashes your gallstones up.
Charming.
Well, it makes you think, doesn't it? He says he can cure anything so long as he gets on the right wavelength.
I know. For an extra five bob, he'll tune both your ear holes into family favourites. What a load of rubbish.
Why don't you sit down and relax? It's a day of rest. Have a kip or something, anything. But do me a favour and shut up.
Oh, dear. What a life. It's Sunday. I've had a rotten dinner. It's raining. And I've got nothing to do.
There's plenty of odd jobs you can do around the house.
Oh, shut up. It's a day of rest. I'm not mending your bed again.
So life in railway cuttings was both authentically seedy and wildly unreal, which is one reason why the girlfriend part of the plot was difficult to manage. The Australian cast member Bill Kerr, looking back 50 years, reckons...
It wasn't until we got wonderful, wonderful Hattie Jakes we were set like a jelly there. We knew that we were on a winner. And Tony used to say the most, you know, outrageous things to her, but it was all done in with such fun. The audience adored her. Well, everyone did. She was a lovely boom. She had a heart as big as herself.
One of the things about Tenney is that he was the most marvellous audience. He always wanted to hear your latest, not jokes, but stories or people you'd met or funnies. He was the most fantastic audience. He laughed himself silly at what I didn't think was anything very funny at the time. But then on the other hand, one must say that we were his best audience too, all the people that worked with him, as apart from all the people that listened to him and saw him and loved him. Because many times when I was on the radio show with Tony, his technique, his way of working, was so brilliant that sometimes, I admit, I even was late on my entrances because I was so enthralled with watching him.
I think Tony was the best that I've ever known to work with. His timing, I've never known better timing. A lot of actors say this is a bad word to use, but I do not. I don't think it's a bad word to use. There isn't a better expression for it. Tony had absolutely instinctive, perfect timing for radio, which is one thing, as you know, I don't have to tell you, and the other one on stage, and then the other medium, television. It was absolutely split-second perfect. I've never known anybody time like his.
He never once, to my knowledge, or suggested anything in the way of storyline, plot lines, jokes,
no, anything. No, he was one of the reasons he was so wonderful to work with, because he let you get on with it. I mean, he showed great confidence in you, which is wonderful. And you know, when somebody's got that much confidence, particularly on the radio shows, when they didn't see the script until the day that they were going to do it. Gosh. It was too late to rewrite or alter. I mean, they showed great confidence. Yeah. Tony was a wonderful reader. First sight, I mean, you give an impeccable performance, first read-through.
And in a crisis, Tony could still be the cooperative trooper he'd been back in the gang show days, with the instincts of a stand-up comic still intact.
We were doing this Hancock's Half Hour from the Camden Theatre, and they warned us halfway there was a break in the recording channel. We couldn't get to the right recording channel. They said, would you fill in for a few minutes? And so Tony Hancock said to all of us, and he said, you come on, all of you, and do the interruption gags. We all had to come on and say, I'm on my way to court with a case, or I've got a pound of meat at Smithfield for one shilling. You had a pound of meat for a shilling? What was it? Mutton? No, rotten. Those sort of awful interruption gags. So I said, I don't know any of them, but I'll do the waffle dust gag, which is I come on, sprinkle waffle dust. You ask me what I'm doing, and I say I'm scattering waffle dust to kill the wild elephants, and you say there are no wild elephants around here, and I say no, but this isn't real waffle dust. So he said, all right, we'll do that one. So I shot onto the stage and was prancing about. I was really prancing all over the shop, throwing this waffle dust, you see. And he didn't say a word. Not a word. And the audience were laughing. So I continued prancing about and got near to him and said, ask me, go on, Tony, ask me what I'm doing, ask me what I'm doing, ask me what I am. Because I was the scatterer of waffle dust, you see. And he just looked at me prancing about the stage with the audience laughing and said, we all know what you are. And the laugh was enormous, you see, because it was egg all over my face, because he hadn't done any of the things he told me he was going to do.
Kenneth Williams, along with Sid James, the most attention-getting of the supporting cast. The rapidly building impetus of the show in the early days was interrupted very rudely once by Hancock himself, who walked out of a stage show at the Adelphi Theatre and, without warning anyone, flew to Italy to recover his composure. It seems to have been more a case of desperation about his live solo act than dread of the oncoming radio series, but it did give BBC producer Dennis Mayne Wilson a serious problem. He solved it by calling Harry Secombe.
Bless his heart, Harry came down from the Midlands where he was on tour. And we opened the first episode of the second series of Hancock's Half Hour with Robin Boyle, the announcer, saying, this is the BBC Light programme, Yabba da Bum Paya. We present Hancock's Half Hour starring Harry Secombe. Wild, wild.
Hancock returned in time for the show to be handed back to him by Secombe in the script for episode 4. But sadly, the evidence of that crisis was excluded from the archives, so we shall never know quite how Secombe went about helping Hancock in his absence. During the two series André Melly played in, and that was one of them, Hancock was not a natural mixer socially, but he did fall into the company of the other cast member with intellectual leanings.
The only one who talked to him, really, was Ken Williams. I'd say hello, and he'd be very sweet with me and nice. But he didn't want to socialise at all. And Ken used to talk to him. You'd see them in corners, sort of, and Ken doing the talking. And I always thought that Tony was almost in awe of Ken, and also quite threatened by him. He felt quite nervous with Ken, because Ken had a very, very good brain and was very erudite on all sorts of subjects. And I think that Tony felt threatened a bit by him. And in fact, when Ken's stumbling about is that character, that funny voice he did, became so popular, I think Tony felt, hello, you know, this is sort of stealing the show.
It's well known that Hancock did eventually take against Kenneth Williams' style of laughter-making, Hancock's rationalisation of his view being that Williams went in for funny voices and catchphrase comedy, which was the old traditional radio way of doing things. Hancock didn't want that anymore, so Williams had to go. Galton and Simpson, trying to be kind, I think, have made out the case that Williams was actually a casualty of the move into TV comedy.
It wasn't Tony throwing him out, it's just that we couldn't find space on the screen to put everyone from the half hour into the television. It didn't seem to work, whereas they could just sort of step up to a microphone and say their piece and maybe, you know, one line and off. But it didn't work that way on television, and we had to pare it down to basically Tony and Sid, and then other people as need be.
But Kenneth Williams disappeared from the last radio series as well, which suggests that the decision to lose him was a question of his suitability not to one medium or the other, but to Hancock.
And then, of course, a big change came when we dispensed with Sid.
That may have been coming quite a while. Harry Taub has this recollection.
The first time I worked with Hancock was on radio, and I was a big fan of the programme. I was pretty chuffed when I found out I was going to be on it. And when I got there, it was a shock of my life, because I'd done a lot of light comedy stuff. And usually when you went into the studio, you know, there were lots of laughs. When I did the Hancock and I went in, the atmosphere was terrible. And I think the series was well on by that time. And I don't know what was going on. There was a hidden atmosphere. It was not so hidden. And whether there was animosity between Sid James and himself, I don't know, but they just muttered their lines, and people who were playing small parts, like myself, were doing their best to act with a capital A. And that's the way they rehearsed. They didn't do anything at all until the show. And then when they did the show and the audience was in, they were terrific.
It would be interesting to know if Harry Taub's experience and the conversation with Hancock that Warren Mitchell recalls happened around the same time.
We had this lunch, and he said to me, I don't want to be part of a double act for the rest of my life with Sid James. That was the first intimation I had that he wasn't satisfied with. And I was shocked and sorrowful, really, because you walk into something that seems to be perfection, and you wanted to go on being that way. You want things to remain as they are, as they were.
Sid?
What?
I'd like to have a word with you in confidence.
What's the matter?
It's Bill. I'm worried about him.
Well, what's wrong with him?
Haven't you noticed in these last few weeks? He's changed, Sid. Never seen anyone change so much as he has.
Well, blimey, he's got to change sometime. He can't stay like that the rest of his life.
No, it's deeper than that. He's got something on his mind. He's gone secretive. He slips out at night without telling me. And he's gone off his food. He wouldn't touch his fish cakes this morning.
Do you blame him? Horrible smelly things?
No, well, I smothered him in his favourite chop sauce. Normally has about 7 or 8 of those. Not today, though. Not a nibble. And there he was, sitting behind him, the top of his old head poking above the breadcrumbs. Picture of dejected gloom. I don't know what's wrong with him.
Well, I wouldn't bother. See what he's like tomorrow, and if he's no better, thump him.
Good psychologist you are, aren't you? When will you realise that gone are the days when the panacea for all ills was to fetch the patient a hefty punch up the bracket?
The very success of Tony and Sid's scenes together came to be for Hancock an argument against the two men carrying on and placing themselves under the threat of being permanently billed as a double act. So, again, Hancock discharged another helper.
And quite right, he said, well, look, Sid James has got a huge career outside of,
of this television series that we do, i.e. makes film after film after film. You know, I get lumbered, well, not lumbered, but I mean, I get coupled with him all the time, and thought there was a time for another move on, so to speak. And this was a suggestion on his part that really that we did drop Sid, much to Sid's mortification.
I would have liked to have gone on for one more series, but only one. And I was very upset, naturally, when he said, well, we've got to break it up now, we've got to make a clean cut. And I said, well, if that's the way it's got to be, that's the way it's got to be.
We also dispensed with a repertory company that we've been employing, like Mario Fabrizi and Johnny Vivian, and one or two others that were in every week, virtually. And then in the last series of Hancock on his own, we lost Sid, and we lost the repertory company, and we just employed genuine, straight actors. And then the last series was different because of that, much more realistic.
Dropping Sid was obviously one of the biggest things that people remember, and a lot of people say, because he was never the same after that, which, of course, is no rubbish, with all due respect to Sid, because Sid was marvellous. But the last series on the television was probably the most successful of Hancock's Half Hour, and had it gone on, would have got closer to reality. But because we only did six without Sid, people forget. If you remind them, say, oh, did you like the Blood Diner? Did you like the Lift? Did you like the Radio Ham? Oh, yeah, Smashing Pumpkins. Well, I'm afraid Sid wasn't in any of those.
It's perfectly true that the classic status of that short, Sidless series directed by Duncan Wood was so instantly obvious that two episodes, The Blood Donor and The Radio Ham, were re-recorded with an invited audience for release on vinyl LP. But the original TV series effectively put an end to Hancock's conventional career as a TV actor, learning lines and speaking them. Just before The Blood Donor, he suffered a car accident which gave him a reason, perhaps an excuse, to claim that his memory simply wouldn't retain the lines. Hugh Lloyd was there.
He'd had a minor crash on the Sunday. He came very much shaken through the first read-through on the Monday, and Duncan Wood said, well, do you want to do it, or, you know, or read it, or go to the pub? So we went to the pub. Tony always had a fear of memory loss, always. But on this occasion, it was even greater. And the whole thing was red. And you could see sometimes the eyes not quite on the right place. But he was always afraid of losing his memory. What he would do, he would learn the show on a Sunday. At the read-through, he would have learned it. He would know it, which is most unusual. Most people wait and learn it after the read-through. On Tuesday, something that I've never experienced before with any other artist, we used to applaud him in the rehearsal room because he was absolutely brilliant. But until the recording started, he was a trembling mass. Once he got a first laugh, he was fine.
From now on, he considered his memory just too faulty to trust. In terms of the BBC tradition, that great series led on to nothing. All that was left in Hancock's TV career were series for ATV and ABC TV. His disastrous one-man show at the Festival Hall, part recorded by TV cameras under shambolic conditions, and the sequence of Australian comedies that was terminated by his death. Of course, there were worthwhile things in Hancock's series for the British commercial companies, and a new wave of actors benefited by their association with Hancock. Alec Brigonzi was one of them.
It sort of snowballed because Duncan Wood was wonderful and he used me in other things. And he also introduced me to other directors, you know, so I did an awful lot at the BBC, you know, with all sorts of people, Frankie Howard, Charlie Drake, Sykes, you know. I mean, I think I worked with nearly all the people that was, you know, had their own shows, maybe only once, but I did work with them. So, I mean, it was a golden period.
Harry Taub, having seen the radio series in action, was in a position to see how things had changed.
When I did the television with him, which was the series he did for ITV, ATV, I think it was, we did the read-through in the morning. I think we started at about 10 o'clock. We read through the script, and at just before 11, the director said, OK, you, you, and you, the Red Lion. And we accompanied the director and Tony to the Red Lion at 11 o'clock. And Tony, God bless him, started off with large brandies. And the incredible thing was, it didn't seem to have any effect on him at all.
He wasn't one of the boys, no. He was, as far as the booze was concerned, that was a problem that he always had to contend with. And I think when he went to ATV, they spent their rehearsals drinking champagne. And they said, don't worry about learning it, Tony. That was a big mistake he made, listening to their blandishments. And they put it up on blackboards for him, and he never did learn it properly.
A curious effect of this practice of reading the lines, whether his employers condoned it or deplored it or even encouraged it, as Warren Mitchell believes, was to turn Hancock's later TV career into an unadmitted extension of his radio days. He didn't have the script in his hand, somebody held it up for him, but otherwise there wasn't a lot of difference. The scripts, of course, were no longer by Galton and Simpson. Hancock and they had no great disagreement on broadcasting matters. It was a feature film that divided them, the intended follow-up to the art world satire The Rebel. Galton and Simpson provided a number of skeleton scripts and one fully fleshed one, but Hancock turned them all down. So G&S returned to TV, wrote the pilot show that turned into Steptoe and Son, and that was that. In a sense, Hancock helped them on that occasion. And as his career slipped downhill, that was more and more often true. It was those who'd supported him, like Warren Mitchell, who now reaped the benefit of their association with a great comedian.
I'd been going for interviews for films and never getting anywhere, and I went for one for a big movie being made in Spain called Manuela, and the producer, Ivan Foxwell, and the director, Guy Hamilton, recognised me from Hancock's Half Hour on telly. And I didn't really have to impress them with my ability to play the part in the film. They were just such fans. They were determined to give me the part in the movie, and they did. And it led to a lot of other things. So, yes, I was very grateful for the fact that I'd been in Hancock's Half Hour. I don't remember anyone who had such goodwill from the rest of the profession. We all wanted him to succeed, and he wanted so much to be in the straight theatre, and he would undoubtedly have gone on to do many more films after that. Not very successful one when he was the painter. He had all the skills of an actor.
And all the instincts, alas, of a stubborn loner. His suicide in 1968, as I recall it, didn't seem to bring the usual anguished cries from friends, if only we could have done something. Hancock's helpers had done everything they could.
Stone me, what a life.